Dr. No by Ian Fleming continued. Disc 2.
Crab Key, said Bond. What sort of a place is that? Quarrel looked at him sharply.
Dat a bad luck place now, Cap'n, he said shortly. Chinee Jamon buy hit during da war and bring in men and dig bird dirt. Don't let nobody land there and don't let no one get off. We gives it a wide berth.
Why's that?
Him have plenty watchmen and guns, machine guns, and a radar and a spotting plane. Friends of mine have landed there and him never been seen again. That Chinee keep him island plenty private.
Tell the truth, Cap'n. Quarrel was apologetic. That Crab Key scare me plenty.
Bond said thoughtfully, "Well, well."
The food came. They ordered another round of drinks and ate. While they ate, Bond gave Quarrel an outline of the Strangways case. Quarrel listened carefully, occasionally asking questions. He was particularly interested in the birds on Crab Key and what the watchmen had said and how the plane was supposed to have crashed. Finally, he pushed his plate away. He wiped the back of his hand across his mouth. He took out a cigarette and lit it. He leant forward.
"Cap'n," he said softly, "I no mind if hit was birds or butterflies or bees. If they was on Crab Key and a commander was sticking his nose into da business, you can bet your bottom dollar him been mashed, him and him girl. Da Chinee mashed them for sure."
Bond looked carefully into the urgent grey eyes. "What makes you so certain?" Quarrel spread his hands. To him the answer was simple.
"Da Chinee love him privacy. Him won't be left alone. I know him kill my friends or to keep folk away from the crab. Him a most powerful man. Him kill anyone what interfere with him."
"Why?"
"Don't rightly know, Cap'n," said Quarrel indifferently. "People dem want different things in this world. And what dem want sufficient dem gets."
A glint of light caught the corner of Bond's eye. He turned quickly. The Chinese girl from the airport was standing in the nearby shadows. Now she was dressed in a tight-fitting sheath of black satin, slashed up one side almost to her hip. She had a Leica with a flash attachment in one hand. The other was in a leather case at her side. The hand came out holding a flash bulb. The girl slipped the base into her mouth to wet it and improve the contact and made to screw it into the reflector.
"Get that girl," said Bond quickly.
In two strides, Quarrel was up with her. He held out his hand.
"Evening, missy," he said softly.
The girl smiled. She let the Leica hang on the thin strap round her neck. She took Quarrel's hand. Quarrel swung her round like a ballet dancer. Now he had her hand behind her back, and she was in the crook of his arm. She looked up at him angrily.
"Don't! You're hurting!"
Quarrel smiled down into the flashing dark eyes in the pale, almond-shaped face.
"Cap'n like you take a drink with we," he said soothingly.
He came back to the table, moving the girl along with him. He hooked a chair out with his foot and sat her down beside him, keeping the grip on her wrist behind her back. They sat bolt upright like quarrelling lovers. Bond looked into the pretty, angry little face.
"Good evening.
What are you doing here? Why do you want another picture of me?"
"I'm doing the night spots."
The cupid's bow of a mouth parted persuasively.
"The first picture of you didn't come out. Tell this man to leave me alone."
"So you work for the Gleaner. What's your name?"
"I won't tell you."
Bond cocked an eyebrow at Quarrel. Quarrel's eyes narrowed. His hand behind the girl's back turned slowly. The girl struggled like an eel, her teeth clenched on her lower lip. Quarrel went on twisting. Suddenly she said,
"Ow!"
sharply, and gasped,
"I'll tell!"
Quarrel eased his grip. The girl looked furiously at Bond.
"Annabel Chung!"
Bond said to Quarrel, "Call the puss fella." Quarrel picked up a fork with his free hand and clanged it against the glass. The big negro hurried up. Bond looked up at him. "Ever seen this girl before?"
"Yeah, boss. She come here sometimes. She been a nuisance. One for me to send her away?"
"No, we like her," said Bond amiably. "But she wants to take a studio portrait of me, and I don't know if she's worth the money. Would you call up the Gleaner and ask if they've got a photographer called Annabel Chung? If she really is one of their people, she ought to be good enough."
"Sure, boss."
The man hurried away. Bond smiled at the girl. "Why didn't you ask that man to rescue you?" The girl glowered at him. "I'm sorry to have to exert pressure," said Bond, but my export manager in London said that Kingston was full of shady characters. I'm sure you're not one of them, but I really can't understand why you're so anxious to get my picture. Tell me why.
What I told you, said the girl sulkily. It's my job.
Bond tried other questions. She didn't answer them. The puss fellow came up.
That's right, boss. Annabel Chung, one of their freelance girls. They say she takes fine pictures. You'll be okay with her.
He looked bland. Studio portrait. Studio bed, more like. Thanks, said Bond. The negro went away. Bond turned back to the girl. Freelance, he said softly. That still doesn't explain who wanted my picture. His face went cold. Now give.
No,
said the girl sullenly. All right, Quarrel. Go ahead. Bond sat back. His instincts told him that this was the $64,000 question. If he could get the answer out of the girl, he might be saved weeks of legwork. Quarrel's right shoulder started to dip downwards. The girl squirmed towards him to ease the pressure, but he held her body away with his free hand. The girl's face strained towards Quarrel's. Suddenly she spat full in his eyes. Quarrel grinned and increased the twist. The girl's feet kicked wildly under the table. She hissed out words in Chinese. Sweat beaded on her forehead. Tell, said Bond softly. Tell, and it will stop, and we'll be friends and have a drink. He was getting worried. The girl's arm must be on the verge of breaking.
Blank you!
Suddenly the girl's left hand flew up and into Quarrel's face. Bond was too slow to stop her. Something glinted, and there was a sharp explosion. Bond snatched at her arm and dragged it back. Blood was streaming down Quarrel's cheek. Glass and metal tinkled onto the table. She had smashed the flash bulb on Quarrel's face. If she had been able to reach an eye, it would have been blinded. Quarrel's free hand went up and felt his cheek. He put it in front of his eyes and looked at the blood.
Aha!
There was nothing but admiration and a feline pleasure in his voice. He said equably to Bond,
We get nothing out of this girl, Captain. She plenty tough. You want for me to break she's arm?
Good God, no. Bond let go the arm he was holding. Let her go. He felt angry with himself for having hurt the girl and still failed, but he had learned something. Whoever was behind her held his people by a steel chain. Quarrel brought the girl's right arm from behind her back. He still held on to the wrist. Now he opened the girl's hand. He looked into her eyes. His own were cruel.
You mark me, missy. Now I mark you.
He brought up his other hand and took the mount of Venus, the soft lozenge of flesh and the palm below her thumb, between his thumb and forefinger. He began to squeeze it. Bond could see his knuckles go white with the pressure. The girl gave a yelp. She hammered at Quarrel's hand and then at his face. Quarrel grinned and squeezed harder. Suddenly he let go. The girl shot to her feet and backed away from the table, her bruised hand at her mouth. She took her hand down and hissed furiously,
"He'll get you! You bastards!"
Then, her Leica dangling, she ran off through the trees. Quarrel laughed shortly. He took a napkin and wiped it down his cheek and threw it on the ground and took up another. He said to Bond,
"She's love Mombi sore long after my face done get healed. That a fine piece of a woman, the love man. When him fat like with that girl, you can tell her'll be good in bed. You know that, Captain?"
"No," said Bond. "That's new to me."
Sure thing. That piece of the hand most indicative. Don't you worry about she,
he added, noticing the dubious expression on Bond's face.
Her's got nothing but a big bruise on she's love, man. But boy, was that a fat love, man. I come back after that girl sometime, see if my theory is the truth.
Appropriately, the band started playing Don't Touch Me Tomato. Bond said, Quarrel, it's time you married and settled down. And you leave that girl alone, or you'll get a knife between your ribs. Now come on, we'll get the check and go. It's 3 o'clock in the morning in London, where I was yesterday. I need a night's sleep. You've got to start getting me into training. I think I'm going to need it. And it's about time you put some plaster on that cheek of yours. She's written her name and address on it. Quarrel grunted reminiscently. He said with quiet pleasure,
That was some tough baby.
He picked up a fork and clanked it against his glass.
Chapter 5. Facts and Figures.
He'll get you! He'll get you! He'll get you, you bastards!
The words were still ringing in Bond's brain the next day as he sat on his balcony and ate a delicious breakfast and gazed out across the riot of tropical gardens to Kingston, 5 miles below him. Now he was sure that Strangways and the girl had been killed. Someone had needed to stop them looking any further into this business, so he had killed them and destroyed the records of what they were investigating. The same person knew or suspected that the Secret Service would follow up Strangways' disappearance. Somehow he had known that Bond had been given the job. He had wanted a picture of Bond, and he had wanted to know where Bond was staying. He would be keeping an eye on Bond to see if Bond picked up any of the leads that had led to Strangways' death. If Bond did so, Bond would also have to be eliminated. There would be a car smash, or a street fight, or some other innocent death. And how, Bond wondered, would this person react to their treatment of the Chung girl? If he was as ruthless as Bond supposed, that would be enough. It showed that Bond was onto something. Perhaps Strangways had made a preliminary report to London before he was killed. Perhaps someone had leaked. The enemy would be foolish to take chances. If he had any sense after the Chung incident, he would deal with Bond, and perhaps also with Quarrel, without delay. Bond lit his first cigarette of the day, the first Royal Blend he had smoked for 5 years, and let the smoke come out between his teeth in a luxurious hiss. That was his enemy appreciation. Now, who was this enemy? Well, there was only one candidate, and a pretty insubstantial one at that, Dr. No. Dr. Julius No, the German-Chinese who owned Crab Key and made his money out of guano. There had been nothing on this man in records, and a signal to the FBI had been negative. The affair of the roseate spoonbills and the trouble with the Audubon Society meant precisely nothing, except, as M had said, that a lot of old women had got excited about some pink storks. All the same, 4 people had died because of these storks, and most significant of all to Bond, Quarrel was scared of Dr. No and his island. That was very odd indeed. Cayman Islanders, least of all Quarrel, did not scare easily. And why had Dr. No got this mania for privacy? Why did he go to such expense and trouble to keep people away from his guano island? Guano. Bird dung. Who wanted the stuff? How valuable was it? Bond was due to call on the governor at 10 o'clock. After he had made his number, he would get hold of the colonial secretary and try and find out all about the damned stuff and about Crab Key, and if possible, about Dr. No. There was a double knock on the door. Bond got up and unlocked it. It was Quarrel, his left cheek decorated with a piratical cross of sticking plaster.
"Morning, Captain. You said 8:30.
"Yes, come on in, Quarrel. We've got a busy day. Had some breakfast?"
"Yes, thank you, Captain. Salt fish, an ackee, and a tot of rum."
"Good God," said Bond, "that's tough stuff to start the day on."
"Most refreshing," said Quarrel stolidly.
They sat down outside on the balcony. Bond offered Quarrel a cigarette and lit one himself. "Now then," he said, "I'll be spending most of the day at King's House, and perhaps at the Jamaica Institute. I shan't need you till tomorrow morning, but there are some things for you to do downtown, all right?"
"Okay, Captain. Just you say."
"First of all, that car of ours is hot. We've got to get rid of it. Go down to Motter's or one of the other hire people and pick up the newest and best little self-drive car you can find, the one with the least mileage, saloon. Take it for a month, right? Then hunt around the waterfront and find 2 men who look as near as possible like us. One must be able to drive a car. Buy them both clothes, at least for their top halves, that look like ours, and the sort of hats we might wear. Say we want a car taken over to Montego tomorrow morning, by the Spanish town, Ocho Rios Road, to be left at Levy's garage there. Ring up Levy and tell him to expect it and keep it for us, right?" Quarrel grinned.
"You want Fox someone?"
"That's right. They'll get £10 each. Say I'm a rich American and I want my car to arrive in Montego Bay driven by a respectable couple of men. Make me out a bit mad. They must be here at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. You'll be here with the other car. See they look the part and send them off in the sunbeam with the roof down, right?"
"Okay, Captain."
"What's happened to that house we had on the North Shore last time? Bow Desert at Morgan's Harbour. Do you know if it's let?"
"Couldn't say, Captain. It's well away from the tourist places and they're asking a big rent for it."
"Well, go to Graham Associates and see if you can rent it for a month, or another bungalow nearby. I don't mind what you pay. Say it's for a rich American Mr. James. Get the keys and pay the rent, and say I'll write and confirm. I can telephone them if they want more details."
Bond reached into his hip pocket and brought out a thick wad of notes. He handed half of it to Quarrel. "Here's £200. That should cover all this. Get in touch if you want some more. You know where I'll be."
"Thanks, Captain,"
said Quarrel, awestruck by the big sum. He stowed it away inside his blue shirt and buttoned the shirt up to his neck.
"Anything else?"
"No, but take a lot of trouble about not being followed. Leave the car somewhere downtown and walk to these places, and watch out particularly for any Chinese near you." Bond got up and they went to the door. "See you tomorrow morning at 6:15, and we'll get over to the North Coast. As far as I can see, that's going to be our base for a while." Quarrel nodded. His face was enigmatic. He said,
"Okay, Captain,"
and went off down the corridor. Half an hour later, Bond went downstairs and took a taxi to King's house. He didn't sign the governor's book in the cool hall. He was put in a waiting room for the quarter of an hour necessary to show him that he was unimportant. Then the ADC came for him and took him up to the governor's study on the first floor. It was a large, cool room smelling of cigar smoke. The acting governor, in a cream tussore suit, with an inappropriate wing collar and spotted bow tie, was sitting at a broad mahogany desk on which there was nothing but the Daily Gleaner, the Times Weekly, and a bowl of hibiscus blossoms. His hands lay flat on the desk in front of him. He was 60-ish, with a red, rather petulant face and bright, bitter blue eyes. He didn't smile or get up. He said,
"Good morning, Mr. Bond. Please sit down."
Bond took the chair across the desk from the governor and sat down. He said, "Good morning, sir," and waited. A friend at the colonial officer told him his reception would be frigid.
"He's nearly at retiring age, only an interim appointment. We had to find an acting governor to take over at short notice when Sir Hugh Foote was promoted. Foote was a great success. This man's not even trying to compete. He knows he's only got the job for a few months while we find someone to replace Foote. This man's been passed over for the governor-generalship of Rhodesia. Now all he wants is to retire and get some directorships in the city. Last thing he wants is any trouble in Jamaica. He keeps on trying to close this Strangways case of yours. Won't like you ferreting about."
The governor cleared his throat. He recognized that Bond wasn't one of the servile ones.
"You wanted to see me?"
"Just to make my number, sir," said Bond equably. "I'm here on the Strangways case. I think you had a signal from the Secretary of State." This was a reminder that the people behind Bond were powerful people. Bond didn't like attempts to squash him or his service.
"I recall the signal. And what can I do for you? So far as we're concerned here, the case is closed."
"In what way closed, sir?" the governor said roughly.
"Strangways obviously did a bunk with a girl. Unbalanced sort of fellow at the best of times. Some of your colleagues don't seem to be able to leave women alone."
The governor clearly included Bond.
"Had to bail the chap out of various scandals before now. Doesn't do the colony any good, Mr. Bond. Hope your people will be sending us a rather better type of man to take his place. That is," he added coldly, "if a regional control man is really needed here. Personally, I have every confidence in our police."
Bond smiled sympathetically. "I'll report your views, sir. I expect my chief will like to discuss them with the Minister of Defence and the Secretary of State. Naturally, if you would like to take over these extra duties, it will be a saving in manpower, so far as my service is concerned. I'm sure the Jamaican Constabulary is most efficient." The governor looked at Bond suspiciously. Perhaps he had better handle this man a bit more carefully.
"This is an informal discussion, Mr. Bond. When I have decided on my views, I will communicate them myself to the Secretary of State. In the meantime, is there anyone you wish to see on my staff?"
"I'd like to have a word with the colonial secretary, sir."
"Really? And why, pray?"
"There's been some trouble on Crab Key. Something about a bird sanctuary. The case was passed to us by the colonial office. My chief asked me to look into it while I'm here." The governor looked relieved.
"Certainly, certainly. I'll see that Mr. Plydell Smith receives you straight away. So you feel we can leave the Strangways case to sort itself out? They'll turn up before long, never fear."
He reached over and rang a bell. The ADC came in.
"This gentleman would like to see the colonial secretary, ADC. Take him along, would you? I'll call Mr. Plydell Smith myself and ask him to make himself available."
He got up and came round the desk. He held out his hand.
"'Goodbye, then, Mr. Bond. "'And I'm so glad we see eye to eye. "'Crab Key, eh? "'Never been there myself, but I'm sure it would repay a visit.'
"'Bond shook hands. "'That was what I was thinking. "'Goodbye, sir.
"'Goodbye. Goodbye.'
"'The governor watched Bond's back retreating out of the door, "'and himself returned well satisfied to his desk. "'Young whippersnapper,' he said to the empty room. He sat down and said a few peremptory words down the telephone to the colonial secretary. Then he picked up the Times Weekly and turned to the stock exchange prices. The colonial secretary was a youngish, shaggy-haired man with bright, boyish eyes. He was one of those nervous pipe-smokers who are constantly patting their pockets for matches, shaking the box to see how many are left in it, or knocking the dottle out of their pipes. After he had gone through this routine two or three times in his first 10 minutes with Bond, Bond wondered if he ever got any smoke into his lungs at all. After pumping energetically at Bond's hand, and waving vaguely at a chair, Pleydell Smith walked up and down the room, scratching his temple with the stem of his pipe.
"'Bond! Bond! Bond! Rings a bell. Now let me see. Yes, by Jove! You were the chap who was mixed up in that treasure business here. By Jove, yes. 4 or 5 years ago. Found the file lying around only the other day. Splendid show. What a luck. I say, we should start another bonfire like that here. Stir the place up a bit. All they think of nowadays is federation and their bloody self-importance. Self-determination, indeed. They can't even run a bus service. And the colour problem. My dear chap, there's far more colour problem between the straight-haired and the crinkly-haired Jamaicans than there is between me and my black cook. However, Pleydell Smith came to rest beside his desk. He sat down opposite Bond and draped one leg over the arm of his chair. Reaching for a tobacco jar with the arms of King's College, Cambridge, on it, he dug into it and started filling his pipe. "'I mean to say, I don't want to bore you with all that. You go ahead and bore me. What's your problem?' "'Glad to help. I bet it's more interesting than this mug.' He waved at the pile of papers in his in-tray. Bond grinned at him. This was more like it. He had found an ally, and an intelligent one at that. "'Well,' he said seriously, "'I'm here on the Strangways case, but first of all I want to ask you a question that may sound odd. Exactly how did you come to be looking at that other case of mine? You say you found the file lying about. How was that? Had someone asked for it?' "'I don't want to be indiscreet, so don't answer if you don't want to. I'm just inquisitive.' Pleydell Smith cocked an eye at him. "'I suppose that's your job,' he reflected, gazing at the ceiling. "'Well, now I come to think of it, I saw it on my secretary's desk. She's a new girl. Said she was trying to get up to date with the files. Mark you,' the colonial secretary hastened to exonerate his girl. "'There were plenty of other files on her desk. It was just this one that caught my eye.' "'Oh, I see,' said Bond. "'It was like that.' He smiled apologetically. "'Sorry, but various people seem to be rather interested in me being here. "'What I really wanted to talk to you about was Crab Key. "'Anything you know about the place. "'And about this Chinaman, Dr. No, who bought it. "'And anything you can tell me about his guano business. "'Rather a tall order, I'm afraid, but any scraps will help.' "'Pleydell Smith laughed shortly through the stem of his pipe. "'He jerked the pipe out of his mouth and talked "'while he tamped down the burning tobacco with his matchbox.' "'Bitten off a bit more than you can chew on, Guano. "'Talk to you for hours about it. "'Started in the consular before I transferred to the colonial office. "'First job was in Peru. "'Had a lot to do with their people who administer the whole trade. "'Compañía Administradora del Guano. "'Nice people.'
"'The pipe was going now, and Pleydell Smith threw his matchbox down on the table.
"'As for the rest, it's just a question of getting the file.'
"'He rang a bell. "'In a minute the door opened behind Bond.'
"'Miss Tarrow, the file on Crab Key, please. "'The one on the sale of the place, "'and the other one on that warden fellow "'who turned up before Christmas. "'Miss Longfellow will know where to find them.'
"'A soft voice said, "'Yes, sir.' "'Bond heard the door close.
"'Now then, Guano.'
"'Pleydell Smith tilted his chair back. "'Bond prepared to be bored.
"'As you know, its bird dung comes from the rear end of two birds, "'the masked booby and the guane. "'So far as Crab Key is concerned, it's only the guane, "'otherwise known as the green cormorant, "'same bird as you find in England. "'The guane is a machine for converting fish into guano. "'They mostly eat anchovies. "'Just to show you how much fish they eat, "'they found up to 70 anchovies inside one bird.'
"'Pleydell Smith took out his pipe and pointed it impressively at Bond.'
The whole population of Peru eats 4,000 tons of fish a year. The seabirds of the country eat 500,000 tons.
Bond pursed his lips to show he was impressed.
Really?
Well now, continued the colonial secretary, Every day, each one of these hundreds of thousands of guanes eat a pound or so of fish and deposit an ounce of guano on the Guanera. That's the guano island. Bond interrupted. Why don't they do it in the sea?
Don't know.
Plydell Smith took the question and turned it over in his mind. Never occurred to me. Anyway, they don't. They do it on the land, and they've been doing it since before Genesis. That makes the hell of a lot of bird dung. Millions of tons of it on the Pescadores and the other Guanera. Then around 1850, someone discovered it was the greatest natural fertilizer in the world, stuffed with nitrates and phosphates and what have you. And the ships and the men came to the Guaneras and simply ravaged them for 20 years or more. It's a time known as the Saturnalia in Peru. It was like the Klondike. People fought over the muck, hijacked each other's ships, shot the workers, sold phony maps of secret guano islands, anything you like, and people made fortunes out of the stuff. Where does Crab Key come in? Bond wanted to get down to cases. That was the only worthwhile Guanera so far north. It was worked, too, God knows who by. But the stuff had a low nitrate content. Water's not as rich round here as it is down along the Humboldt Current. So the fish aren't so rich in chemicals. So the guano isn't so rich either. Crab Key got worked on and off when the price was high enough. But the whole industry went bust with Crab Key and the other poor quality deposits in the van when the Germans invented artificial chemical manure. By this time, Peru had realized that she had squandered a fantastic capital asset, and she set about organizing the remains of the industry and protecting the Guanera. She nationalized the industry and protected the birds. And slowly, very slowly, the supplies built up again. Then people found that there were snags about the German stuff. It impoverishes the soil, which guano doesn't do. And gradually the price of guano improved, and the industry staggered back to its feet. Now it's going fine. Except that Peru keeps most of the guano to herself for her own agriculture, and that was where Crab Key came in again. Ah, yes, said Lytle Smith, patting his pockets for the matches, finding them on the desk, shaking them against his ear and starting his pipe-filling routine. At the beginning of the war, this Chinaman, who must be a wily devil, by the way, got the idea that he could make a good thing out of the old Guanera on Crab Key. The price was about $50 a ton on this side of the Atlantic, and he bought the island from us for about £10,000, as I recall it. Brought in labour and got to work. Been working it ever since. Must have made a fortune. He ships direct to Europe, to Antwerp. They send him a ship once a month. He's installed the latest crushers and separators. Sweats his labour, I dare say. To make a decent profit, he'd have to, particularly now. Last year I heard he was only getting about $38 to $40 a ton, CIF, Antwerp. God knows what he must pay his labour to make a profit at that price. I've never been able to find out. He runs that place like a fortress, sort of forced labour camp. No one ever gets off it. I've heard some funny rumours, but no one's ever complained. It's his island, of course, and he can do what he likes on it. Bond hunted for clues. Would it really be so valuable to him, this place? What do you suppose it's worth? Plydell Smith said, The guano is the most valuable bird in the world. Each pair produces about $2 worth of guano in a year without any expense to the owner. Each female lays an average of 3 eggs and raises 2 young, 2 broods a year. Say they're worth $15 a pair, and say there are 100,000 birds on Crab Key, which is a reasonable guess on the old figures we have. That makes his birds worth $1.5 million. Pretty valuable property. Add the value of the installations, say another million, and you've got a small fortune on that hideous little place. Which reminds me, Plydell Smith pressed the bell, what the hell has happened to those files? You'll find all the dope you want in them. The door opened behind Bond. Plydell Smith said irritably, Really, Miss Tarrow, what about those files?
Very sorry, sir, said the soft voice, but we can't find them anywhere.
What do you mean, can't find them? Who had them last?
Commander Strangways, sir.
Well, I remember distinctly him bringing them back to this room. What happened to them then?
Can't say, sir.
The voice was unemotional.
The covers are there, but there's nothing inside them.
Bond turned in his chair. He glanced at the girl and turned back. He smiled grimly to himself. He knew where the files had gone. He also knew why the old file on himself had been out on the secretary's desk. He also guessed how the particular significance of James Bond, import and export merchant, seemed to have leaked out of King's House, the only place where the significance was known. Like Dr. No, like Miss Annabel Chung, the demure, efficient-looking little secretary in the horn-rimmed glasses was a Chinese.
Chapter 6. The Finger on the Trigger. The colonial secretary gave Bond lunch at Queen's Club.
They sat in a corner of the elegant mahogany-panelled dining room with its four big ceiling fans, and gossiped about Jamaica. By the time coffee came, Plydell Smith was delving well below the surface of the prosperous, peaceful island the world knows. "It's like this," he began his antics with a pipe. "The Jamaican is a kindly, lazy man with the virtues and vices of a child. He lives on a very rich island, but he doesn't get rich from it. He doesn't know how to, and he's too lazy. The British come and go and take the easy pickings, but for about 200 years no Englishman has made a fortune out here. He doesn't stay long enough. He takes a fat cart and leaves. It's the Portuguese Jews who make the most. They came here with the British, and they stayed. But they're snobs, and they spend too much of their fortunes on building fine houses and giving dances. They're the names that fill the social column in the Gleaner when the tourists have gone. They're in rum and tobacco, and they represent the big British firms over here, motor cars, insurance, and so forth. Then come the Syrians, very rich too, but not such good businessmen. They have most of the stores and some of the best hotels. They're not a very good risk. Get overstocked and have to have an occasional fire to get liquid again. Then there are the Indians with their usual flashy trade in soft goods and the like. They're not much of a lot. Finally, there are the Chinese, solid, compact, discreet, the most powerful clique in Jamaica. They've got the bakeries and the laundries and the best food stores. They keep to themselves and keep their strain pure." Plydell Smith laughed. "Not that they don't take the black girls when they want them. You can see the result all over Kingston. Chigros, Chinese negroes and negresses. The Chigros are a tough, forgotten race. They look down on the negroes, and the Chinese look down on them. One day they may become a nuisance. They've got some of the intelligence of the Chinese and most of the vices of the black man. The police have a lot of trouble with them." Bond said, "That secretary of yours, would she be one of them?" "That's right. Bright girl and very efficient. Had her for about 6 months. She was far the best of the ones that answered our advertisement." "She looks bright," said Bond noncommittally. "Are they organized, these people? Is there some head of the Chinese Negro community?" "Not yet. But someone'll get hold of them one of these days. They'd be a useful little pressure group." Plydell Smith glanced at his watch. "That reminds me. Must be getting along. Got to go and read the Riot Act about those files. Can't think what happened to them. I distinctly remember—" He broke off. "However, main point is that I haven't been able to give you much dope about Crab Key and this doctor fellow, but I can tell you there wasn't much you'd have found out from the files. He seems to have been a pleasant-spoken chap, very businesslike. Then there was that argument with the Audubon Society. I gather you know all about that. As for the place itself, there was nothing on the files but one or two pre-war reports and a copy of the last Ordnance Survey. God-forsaken bloody place, it sounds. Nothing but miles of mangrove swamps and a huge mountain of bird dung at one end. But you said you were going down to the Institute. Why don't I take you there and introduce you to the fellow who runs the map section?" An hour later, Bond was ensconced in a corner of a sombre room with the Ordnance Survey map of Crab Key, dated 1910, spread out on a table in front of him. He had a sheet of the Institute's writing paper and had made a rough sketch map and was jotting down the salient points. The overall area of the island was about 50 square miles. 3/4 of this, to the east, was swamp and shallow lake. From the lake, a flat river meandered down to the sea and came out halfway along the south coast into a small sandy bay. Bond guessed that somewhere at the headwaters of the river would be a likely spot for the Audubon wardens to have chosen for their camp. To the west, the island rose steeply to a hill stated to be 500 feet high, and ended abruptly with what appeared to be a sheer drop to the sea. A dotted line led from this hill to a box in the corner of the map, which contained the words "Guano Deposits, Last Workings 1880. There was no sign of a road or even of a track on the island, and no sign of a house. The relief map showed that the island looked rather like a swimming water rat, a flat spine rising sharply to the head, heading west. It appeared to be about 30 miles due north of Galena Point on the north shore of Jamaica, and about 60 miles south of Cuba. Little else could be gleaned from the map. Crab Key was surrounded by shoal water, except below the western cliff, where the nearest marking was 500 fathoms. After that came the plunge into the Cuba Deep. Bond folded the map and handed it in to the librarian. Suddenly he felt exhausted. It was only 4 o'clock, but it was roasting in Kingston, and his shirt was sticking to him. Bond walked out of the Institute and found a taxi and went back up into the cool hills to his hotel. He was well satisfied with his day, but nothing else could be done on this side of the island. He would spend a quiet evening at his hotel and be ready to get up early next morning and be away. Bond went to the reception desk to see if there was a message from Quarrel.
"No messages, sir," said the girl. "But a basket of fruit came from King's House just after lunch. The messenger took it up to your room."
"What sort of a messenger?"
"Coloured man, sir. Said he was from the ADC's office."
"Thank you." Bond took his key and went up the stairs to the first floor. It was ridiculously improbable. His hand on the gun under his coat, Bond softly approached his door. He turned the key and kicked the door open. The empty room yawned at him. Bond shut and locked the door. On his dressing table was a large, ornate basket of fruit. Tangerines, grapefruit, pink bananas, soursop, star apples, and even a couple of hothouse nectarines. Attached to a broad ribbon on the handle was a white envelope. Bond removed it and held it up to the light. He opened it. On a plain sheet of expensive white writing paper was typed, "With the compliments of His Excellency the Governor." Bond snorted. He stood looking at the fruit. He bent his ear to it and listened. He then took the basket by the handle and tipped its contents out onto the floor. The fruit bounced and rolled over the coconut matting. There was nothing but fruit in the basket. Bond grinned at his precautions. There was a last possibility. He picked up one of the nectarines, the most likely for a greedy man to choose first, and took it into the bathroom. He dropped it in the wash-basin and went back to the bedroom and, after inspecting the lock, unlocked the wardrobe. Gingerly he lifted out his suitcase and stood it in the middle of the room. He knelt down and looked for the traces of talcum powder he had dusted round the two locks. They were smeared, and there were minute scratches round the keyholes. Bond sourly examined the marks. These people were not as careful as some others he had had to deal with. He unlocked the case and stood it up on end. There were four innocent copper studs in the welting at the front right-hand corner of the lid. Bond prized at the top of one of these studs with his nail, and it eased out. He took hold of it and pulled out 3 feet of thick steel wire and put it on the floor beside him. This wire threaded through small wire loops inside the lid and sewed the case shut. Bond lifted the lid and verified that nothing had been disturbed. From his tool case, he took out a jeweler's glass and went back into the bathroom and switched on the light over the shaving mirror. He screwed the glass into his eye and gingerly picked the nectarine out of the washbasin and revolved it slowly between finger and thumb. Bond stopped turning the nectarine. He had come to a minute pinhole, its edges faintly discoloured brown. It was in the crevice of the fruit, invisible except under a magnifying glass. Bond put the nectarine carefully down in the washbasin. He stood for a moment and looked thoughtfully into his eyes in the mirror. So it was war. Well, well, how very interesting. Bond felt the slight tautening of the skin at the base of his stomach. He smiled thinly at his reflection in the mirror. So his instincts and his reasoning had been correct. Strangways and the girl had been murdered, and their records destroyed, because they had got too hot on the trail. Then Bond had come on the scene, and, thanks to Miss Tarrow, they had been waiting for him. Miss Chung and perhaps the taxi driver had picked up the scent. He had been traced to the Blue Hills Hotel. The first shot had been fired. There would be others. And whose finger was on the trigger? Who had got him so accurately in his sights? Bond's mind was made up. The evidence was nil, but he was certain of it. This was long-range fire from Crab Key. The man behind the gun was Dr. No. Bond walked back into the bedroom. One by one he picked up the fruit and took each piece back to the bathroom and examined it through his glass. The pinprick was always there, concealed in the stalk hole or a crevice. Bond rang down and asked for a cardboard box and paper and string. He packed the fruit carefully in the box and picked up the telephone and called King's House. He asked for the colonial secretary. "That you, Plydell Smith? James Bond speaking. Sorry to bother you. Got a bit of a problem. Is there a public analyst in Kingston?" "I see. Well, I've got something I want analysed. If I sent the box down to you, would you be very kind and pass it on to this chap? I don't want my name to come into this. All right?" "I'll explain later. When you get his report, would you send me a short telegram telling me the answer? I'll be at Bow Desert, over at Morgan's Harbour, for the next week or so. Be glad if you'd keep that to yourself, too. Sorry to be so damned mysterious. I'll explain everything when I see you next. I expect you'll get a clue when you see what the analyst has to say. And by the way, tell him to handle the specimens carefully, would you? Warn him there's more in them than meets the eye. Very many thanks."
Lucky I met you this morning. Goodbye. Bond addressed the parcel and went down and paid a taxi to deliver it at once to King's house. It was 6 o'clock. He went back to his room and had a shower and changed and ordered his first drink. He was about to take it out on the balcony when the telephone rang. It was Quarrel.
"Everything fixed, Captain."
"Everything? That's wonderful. That house all right?"
"Everything okay," Quarrel repeated, his voice careful. "See you as you done said, Captain."
"Fine," said Bond. He was impressed with Quarrel's efficiency and a sense of security. He put down the telephone and went out onto the balcony. The sun was just setting. The wave of violet shadow was creeping down towards the town and the harbour. When it hits the town, thought Bond, the lights will go on. It happened as he had expected. Above him there was the noise of a plane. It came into sight. A super constellation. The same flight that Bond had been on the night before. Bond watched it sweep out over the sea, and then turn and come into land at the Palisados airport. What a long way he had come since that moment, only 24 hours before, when the door of the plane had clanged open, and the loudspeaker had said, "This is Kingston, Jamaica. Will passengers please remain seated until the aircraft has been cleared by the health authorities?" Should he tell M how the picture had changed? Should he make a report to the governor? Bond thought of the governor and dismissed that idea. But what about M? Bond had his own cipher. He could easily send M a signal through the colonial office. What would he say to M? That Dr. No had sent him some poisoned fruit? But he didn't even know that it was poisoned, or, for the matter of that, that it had come from Dr. No. Bond could see M's face as he read the signal. He saw him press down the lever on the intercom.
"Chief of Staff, 007's gone round the bend. Says someone's been trying to feed him a poisoned banana. Fellow's lost his nerve, been in hospital too long. Better call him home."
Bond smiled to himself. He got up and rang down for another drink. It wouldn't be quite like that, of course. But still... No, he'd wait until he had something more to show. Of course, if something went badly wrong, and he hadn't sent a warning, he'd be in trouble. It was up to him to see that nothing did go wrong. Bond drank his second drink and thought over the details of his plan. Then he went down and had dinner in the half-deserted dining room, and read the Handbook of the West Indies. By 9 o'clock he was half asleep. He went back to his room and packed his bag ready for the morning. He telephoned down and arranged to be called at 5:30. Then he bolted the door on the inside and also shut and bolted the slatted jalousies across the windows. It would mean a hot, stuffy night. That couldn't be helped. Bond climbed naked under the single cotton sheet and turned over on his left side and slipped his right hand onto the butt of the Walter PPK under the pillow. In 5 minutes he was asleep. The next thing Bond knew was that it was 3 o'clock in the morning. He knew it was 3 o'clock because the luminous dial of his watch was close to his face. He lay absolutely still. There was not a sound in the room. He strained his ears. Outside, too, it was deathly quiet. Far in the distance, a dog started to bark. Other dogs joined in, and there was a brief hysterical chorus which stopped as suddenly as it had begun. Then it was quite quiet again. The moon coming through the slats in the jalousies threw black and white bars across the corner of the room next to his bed. It was as if he was lying in a cage. What had woken him up? Bond moved softly, preparing to slip out of bed. Bond stopped moving. He stopped as dead as a live man can. Something had stirred on his right ankle. Now it was moving up the inside of his shin. Bond could feel the hairs on his leg being parted. It was an insect of some sort, a very big one. It was long, 5 or 6 inches, as long as his hand. He could feel dozens of tiny feet lightly touching his skin. What was it? Then Bond heard something he had never heard before, the sound of the hair on his head rasping up on the pillow. Bond analyzed the noise. It couldn't be. It simply couldn't. Yes, his hair was standing on end. Bond could even feel the cool air reaching his scalp between the hairs. How extraordinary, how very extraordinary. He had always thought it was a figure of speech. But why? Why was it happening to him? The thing on his leg moved. Suddenly Bond realized that he was afraid, terrified. His instincts, even before they had communicated with his brain, had told his body that he had a centipede on him. Bond lay frozen. He had once seen a tropical centipede in a bottle of spirit on the shelf in a museum. It had been pale brown and very flat and 5 or 6 inches long, about the length of this one. On either side of the blunt head there had been curved poison claws. The label on the bottle had said that its poison was mortal if it hit an artery. Bond had looked curiously at the corkscrew of dead cuticle and had moved on. The centipede had reached his knee. It was starting up his thigh. Whatever happened, he mustn't move, mustn't even tremble. Bond's whole consciousness had drained down to the two rows of softly creeping feet. Now they had reached his flank. God, it was turning down towards his groin. Bond set his teeth, supposing it liked the warmth there. Supposing it tried to crawl into the crevices, could he stand it? Supposing it chose that place to bite? Bond could feel it questing amongst the first hairs. It tickled. The skin on Bond's belly fluttered. There was nothing he could do to control it. But now the thing was turning up and along his stomach. Its feet were gripping tighter to prevent it falling. Now it was at his heart. If it bit there, surely it would kill him. The centipede trampled steadily on through the thin hairs on Bond's right breast, up to his collarbone. It stopped. What was it doing? Bond could feel the blunt head questing blindly to and fro. What was it looking for? Was there room between his skin and the sheet for it to get through? Dare he lift the sheet an inch to help it? No, never. The animal was at the base of his jugular. Perhaps it was intrigued by the heavy pulse there. Christ, if only he could control the pumping of his blood. Damn you. Bond tried to communicate with the centipede. It's nothing. It's not dangerous, that pulse. It means you no harm. Get on out into the fresh air. As if the beast had heard, it moved on up the column of the neck and into the stubble on Bond's chin. Now it was at the corner of his mouth, tickling madly. On it went, up along the nose. Now he could feel its whole weight and length. Softly, Bond closed his eyes. Two by two, the pairs of feet, moving alternately, trampled across his right eyelid. When it got off his eye, should he take a chance and shake it off, rely on its feet slipping in his sweat? No, for God's sake. The grip of the feet was endless. He might shake one lot off, but not the rest. With incredible deliberation, the huge insect ambled across Bond's forehead. It stopped below the hair. What the hell was it doing now? Bond could feel it nuzzling at his skin. It was drinking. Drinking the beads of salt sweat. Bond was sure of it. For minutes it hardly moved. Bond felt weak with the tension. He could feel the sweat pouring off the rest of his body onto the sheet. In a second his limbs would start to tremble. He could feel it coming on. He would start to shake with an ague of fear. Could he control it? Could he? Bond lay and waited, the breath coming softly through his open, snarling mouth. The centipede started to move again. It walked into the forest of hair. Bond could feel the roots being pushed aside as it forced its way along. Would it like it there? Would it settle down? How did centipedes sleep? Curled up or at full length? The tiny centipedes he had known as a child, the ones that always seemed to find their way up the plug hole into the empty bath, curled up when you touched them. Now it had come to where his head lay against the sheet. Would it walk out onto the pillow, or would it stay on in the warm forest? The centipede stopped. Out! Out! Bond's nerves screamed at it. The centipede stirred. Slowly it walked out of his hair onto the pillow. Bond waited a second. Now he could hear the rows of feet picking softly at the cotton. It was a tiny scraping noise like soft fingernails. With a crash that shook the room, Bond's body jackknifed out of bed and onto the floor. At once Bond was on his feet and at the door. He turned on the light. He found he was shaking uncontrollably. He staggered to the bed. There it was, crawling out of sight over the edge of the pillow. Bond's first instinct was to twitch the pillow onto the floor. He controlled himself, waiting for his nerves to quieten. Then softly, deliberately, he picked up the pillow by one corner and walked into the middle of the room and dropped it. The centipede came out from under the pillow. It started to snake swiftly away across the matting. Now Bond was uninterested. He looked round for something to kill it with. Slowly he went and picked up a shoe and came back. The danger was past. His mind was now wondering how the centipede had got into his bed. He lifted the shoe and slowly, almost carelessly, smashed it down. He heard the crack of the hard carapace. Bond lifted the shoe. The centipede was whipping from side to side in its agony, 5 inches of grey-brown, shiny death. Bond hit it again. It burst open, yellowly. Bond dropped the shoe and ran for the bathroom and was violently sick. Chapter 7 Night Passage. By the way, Quarrel, Bond dared a bus with brown bomber painted above its windshield. The bus pulled over and roared on down the hill towards Kingston, sounding a furious chord on its triple windhorn to restore the driver's ego. What do you know about centipedes?
Centipedes, Captain?
Quarrel squinted sideways for a clue to the question. Bond's expression was casual.
Well, we got some bad ones here in Jamaica. 3, 4, 5 inches long. They kills folks. They mostly lives in the old houses in Kingston. They loves the rotten wood and the mouldy places. They operates mostly at night. Why, Captain? You seen one?
Bond dodged the question. He had also not told Quarrel about the fruit. Quarrel was a tough man, but there was no reason to sow the seeds of fear. Would you expect to find one in a modern house, for instance? In your shoe, or in a drawer, or in your bed?
No, sir.
Quarrel's voice was definite.
Not unless them put there a purpose. These hinsects love the holes and the crannies. They not love the clean places. They dirty livin' hinsects. Maybe you'll find them in the bush, under logs and stones, but never in the bright places.
I see. Bond changed the subject. By the way, did those two men get off all right in the sunbeam?
Sure thing, Captain. They plenty happy with the job, and they look plenty like you and me, Captain.
Quarrel chuckled. He glanced at Bond and said hesitantly,
I fears they weren't very good citizens, Captain. Had to find the two men where's I could. Me, I'm a beggar man, Captain. And for you, Captain, I get a miserable no-good white man from Betsy's.
Who's Betsy?
She done run the lousiest brothel in town, Captain.
Quarrel spat emphatically out of the window.
This white man, he does the bookkeeping.
Bond laughed. So long as he can drive a car. I only hope they get to Montego, all right.
Don't you worry.
Quarrel misunderstood Bond's concern.
I say I tell the police they stole the car if they don't.
They were at the Saddleback at Stony Hill, where the junction road dives down through 50 S-bends towards the north coast. Bond put the little Austin A-30 into second gear and let it coast. The sun was coming up over the Blue Mountain Peak, and dusty shafts of gold lanced into the plunging valley. There were few people on the road, an occasional man going off to his precipitous small holding on the flank of a hill, his 3-foot steel cutlass dangling from his right hand, chewing at his breakfast, a foot of raw sugarcane held in his left, or a woman sauntering up the road with a covered basket of fruit or vegetables for Stony Hill Market, her shoes on her head to be donned when she got near the village. It was a savage, peaceful scene that had hardly changed, except for the surface of the road, for 200 years or more. Bond almost smelled the dung of the mule train in which he would have been riding over from Port Royal to visit the garrison at Morgan's Harbour in 1750. Quarrel interrupted his thoughts.
"Captain," he said apologetically, "begging your pardon, but can you tell me what you have in mind for we? I'se been puzzling, and I can't seem to figure out your game."
"I've hardly figured it out myself, Quarrel." Bond changed up into top and dawdled through the cool, beautiful glades of Castleton Gardens. "I told you I'm here because Commander Strangways and his secretary have disappeared. Most people think they've gone off together. I think they've been murdered."
"That's so," said Quarrel unemotionally. "Who you think done hit?"
"I've come to agree with you. I think Dr. No, that Chinaman on Crab Key, had it done. Strangways was poking his nose into this man's affairs. Something to do with the bird sanctuary. Dr. No has this mania for privacy. You were telling me so yourself. Seems he'll do anything to stop people climbing over his wall. Mark you, it's not more than a guess about Dr. No, but some funny things happened in the last 24 hours. That's why I sent the Sunbeam over to Montego to lay a false scent, and that's why we're going to hide out at the Bow Desert for a few days."
"Din what, Captain?"
"First of all, I want you to get me absolutely fit, the way you trained me the last time I was here, remember?"
"Sure, Captain. I can do dat thing."
"And then I was thinking you and me might go and take a look at Crab Key." Quarrel whistled. The whistle ended on a downward note. "Just sniff around. We needn't get too close to Dr. No's end. I want to take a look at this bird sanctuary, see for myself what happened to the warden's camp. If we find anything wrong, we'll get away again and come back by the front door with some soldiers to help. Have a full-dress inquiry. Can't do that until we've got something to go on. What do you think?" Quarrel dug into his hip pocket for a cigarette. He made a fuss about lighting it. He blew a cloud of smoke through his nostrils and watched it whip out of the window. He said,
"Captain, I think you're plumb crazy to trespass on that island."
Quarrel had wound himself up. He paused. There was no comment. He looked sideways at the quiet profile. He said more quietly, in an embarrassed voice,
"Just one thing, Captain. I have some folks back in the Caymans. Would you consider taking out life insurance on me afore we sail?"
Bond glanced affectionately at the strong brown face. It had a deep cleft of worry between the eyes. "Of course, Quarrel. I'll fix it at Port Maria tomorrow. We'll make it big, say £5,000. Now then, how shall we go? Canoe?"
"That's right, Captain." Quarrel's voice was reluctant. "We need a calm sea and a light wind. Come in on the nor'easterly trades. Must be a dark night. They starting right now. By end of the week we get the second moon quarter. Where you reckon to land, Captain?"
"South shore, near the mouth of the river. Then we'll go up the river to the lake. I'm sure that's where the warden's camp was. So as to have fresh water and be able to get down to the sea to fish." Quarrel grunted without enthusiasm.
"How long we staying, Captain? Can't take a whole lot of food with us. Bread, cheese, salt, pork? No tobacco. Can't risk the smoke and light. That's mighty rough country, Captain. Marsh and mangrove."
Bond said, "Better plan for 3 days. Weather may break and stop us getting off for a night or two. Couple of good hunting knives. I'll take a gun. You never can tell."
"No, sir," said Quarrel emphatically.
He relapsed into a brooding silence, which lasted until they got to Port Maria. They went through the little town and on round the headland to Morgan's Harbour. It was just as Bond remembered, the sugar loaf of the Isle of Surprise rising out of the calm bay, the canoes drawn up beside the mounds of empty conch shells, the distant boom of the surf on the reef, which had so nearly been his grave. Bond, his mind full of memories, took the car down the little side road and through the cane fields, in the middle of which the gaunt ruin of the old great house of Bow Desert Plantation stood up like a stranded galleon. They came to the gate leading to the bungalow. Quarrel got out and opened the gate, and Bond drove through and pulled up in the yard behind the white, single-storied house. It was very quiet. Bond walked round the house and across the lawn to the edge of the sea. Yes, there it was, the stretch of deep, silent water, the submarine path he had taken to the Isle of Surprise. It sometimes came back to him in nightmares. Bond stood looking at it and thinking of Solitaire, the girl he had brought back, torn and bleeding from that sea. He had carried her across the lawn to the house. What had happened to her? Where was she? Brusquely, Bond turned and walked back into the house, driving the phantoms away from him. It was 8:30. Bond unpacked his few things and changed into sandals and shorts. Soon there was the delicious smell of coffee and frying bacon. They ate their breakfast while Bond fixed his training routine. Up at 7, swim a quarter of a mile, breakfast, an hour's sunbathing, run a mile, swim again, lunch, sleep, sunbathe, swim a mile, hot bath, and massage, dinner and asleep by 9. After breakfast the routine began. Nothing interrupted the grinding week except a brief story in the Daily Gleaner and a telegram from Plydell Smith. The Gleaner said that a Sunbeam Talbot, H2473, had been involved in a fatal accident on the Devil's Racecourse, a stretch of winding road between Spanish Town and Ocho Rios, on the Kingston-Montego route. A runaway lorry, whose driver was being traced, had crashed into the Sunbeam as it came round a bend. Both vehicles had left the road and hurtled into the ravine below. The two occupants of the Sunbeam, Ben Gibbons of Harbour Street and Josiah Smith, no address, had been killed. A Mr. Bond, an English visitor who had been lent the car, was asked to contact the nearest police station. Bond burned that copy of the Gleaner. He didn't want to upset Quarrel. With only one day to go, the telegram came from Plydell Smith. It said, "Each object contained enough cyanide to kill a horse. Stop. Suggest you change your grocer. Stop. Good luck, Smith." Bond also burned the telegram. Quarrel hired a canoe, and they spent 3 days sailing it. It was a clumsy shell cut out of a single giant cotton tree. It had two thin thwarts, two heavy paddles, and a small sail of dirty canvas. It was a blunt instrument. Quarrel was pleased with it.
7-8 hours, Captain, he said. Then we bring down the sail and use the paddles. Let's target for the radar to see.
The weather held. The forecast from Kingston Radio was good. The nights were as black as sin. The two men got in their stores. Bond fitted himself out with cheap black canvas jeans and a dark blue shirt and rope-soled shoes. The last evening came. Bond was glad he was on his way. He had only once been out of the training camp, to get the stores and arrange Quarrel's insurance, and he was chafing to get out of the stable and onto the track. He admitted to himself that this adventure excited him. It had the right ingredients, physical exertion, mystery, and a ruthless enemy. He had a good companion. His cause was just. There might also be the satisfaction of throwing the holiday in the sun back in M's teeth. That had rankled. Bond didn't like being coddled. The sun blazed beautifully into its grave. Bond went into his bedroom and took out his two guns and looked at them. Neither was a part of him, as the Beretta had been, an extension of his right hand. But he already knew them as better weapons. Which should he take? Bond picked up each in turn, hefting them in his hand. It had to be the heavier Smith & Wesson. There would be no close shooting, if there was any shooting on Crab Key. Heavy, long-range stuff, if anything. The brutal, stumpy revolver had an extra 25 yards over the Walter. Bond fitted the holster into the waistband of his jeans and clipped in the gun. He put 20 spare rounds in his pocket. Was it over-insurance to take all this metal on what might only be a tropical picnic? Bond went to the icebox and took a pint of Canadian Club blended rye and some ice and soda water and went and sat in the garden and watched the last light flame and die. The shadows crept from behind the house and marched across the lawn and enveloped him. The undertaker's wind that blows at night from the centre of the island clattered softly in the tops of the palm trees. The frogs began to tinkle among the shrubs. The fireflies, the blinker-blinks, as Quarrel called them, came out and began flashing their sexual morse. For a moment the melancholy of the tropical dusk caught at Bond's heart. He picked up the bottle and looked at it. He had drunk a quarter of it. He poured another big slug into his glass and added some ice. What was he drinking for? Because of the 30 miles of Black Sea he had to cross tonight? Because he was going into the unknown? Because of Dr. No? Quarrel came up from the beach.
Time, Captain.
Bond swallowed his drink and followed the Cayman Islander down to the canoe. It was rocking quietly in the water, its bows on the sand. Quarrel went aft, and Bond climbed into the space between the forehead thwart and the bows. The sail, wrapped round the short mast, was at his back. Bond took up his paddle and pushed off, and they turned slowly and headed out for the break in the softly creaming waves that was the passage through the reef. They paddled easily, in unison, the paddles turning in their hands so that they did not leave the water on the forward stroke. The small waves slapped softly against the bows. Otherwise they made no noise. It was dark. Nobody saw them go. They just left the land and went off across the sea. Bond's only duty was to keep paddling. Quarrel did the steering. At the opening through the reef there was a swirl and suck of conflicting currents, and they were in amongst the jagged niggerheads and coral trees bared like fangs by the swell. Bond could feel the strength of Quarrel's great sweeps with the paddle as the heavy craft wallowed and plunged. Again and again, Bond's own paddle thudded against rock, and once he had to hold on as the canoe hit a buried mass of brain coral and slid off again. Then they were through, and far below the boat there were indigo patches of sand, and around them the solid, oily feel of deep water.
"Okay, Captain," said Quarrel softly.
Bond shipped his paddle and got down off one knee and sat with his back to the thwart. He heard the scratching of Quarrel's nails against canvas as he unwrapped the sail, and then the sharp flap as it caught the breeze. The canoe straightened and began to move. It tilted slowly. There was a soft hiss under the bows. A handful of spray tossed up into Bond's face. The wind of their movement was cool and would soon get cold. Bond hunched up his knees and put his arms round them. The wood was already beginning to bite into his buttocks and his back. It crossed his mind that it was going to be the hell of a long and uncomfortable night. In the darkness ahead, Bond could just make out the rim of the world. Then came a layer of black haze above which the stars began, first sparsely and then merging into a dense, bright carpet. The Milky Way soared overhead. How many stars? Bond tried counting a finger's length and was soon past the 100. The stars lit the sea into a faint grey road and then arched away over the tip of the mast towards the black silhouette of Jamaica. Bond looked back. Behind the hunched figure of Quarrel, there was a faraway cluster of lights which would be Port Maria. Already they were a couple of miles out. Soon they would be a tenth of the way, then a quarter, then half. That would be around midnight, when Bond would take over. Bond sighed and put his head down to his knees and closed his eyes. He must have slept, because he was awakened by the clonk of a paddle against the boat. He lifted his arm to show that he had heard, and glanced at the luminous blaze of his watch. 12:15. Stiffly he unbent his legs and turned and scrambled over the thwart. "Sorry, Quarrel," he said, and it was odd to hear his voice. "You ought to have shaken me up before."
"It don't signify, Cap'n," said Quarrel, with a grey glint of teeth. "Do your good to sleep."
Gingerly they slipped past each other, and Bond settled in the stern and picked up the paddle. The sail was secured to a bent nail beside him. It was flapping. Bond brought the bows into the wind and edged them round so that the North Star was directly over Quarrel's bent head in the bows. For a time this would be fun. There was something to do. There was no change in the night except that it seemed darker and emptier. The pulse of the sleeping sea seemed slower. The heavy swell was longer and the troughs deeper. They were running through a patch of phosphorus that winked at the bows and dripped jewels when Bond lifted the paddle out of the water. How safe it was, slipping through the night in this ridiculously vulnerable little boat. How kind and soft the sea could be. A covey of flying fish broke the surface in front of the bows and scattered like shrapnel. Some kept going for a time beside the canoe, flying as much as 20 yards before they dived into the wall of the swell. Was some bigger fish after them, or did they think the canoe was a fish, or were they just playing? Bond thought of what was going on in the hundreds of fathoms below the boat, the big fish, the shark and barracuda and tarpon and sailfish quietly cruising, the shoals of kingfish and mackerel and bonito, and far below, in the grey twilight of the great depths, the phosphorus, jellied, boneless things that were never seen, the 50-foot squids with eyes a foot wide that streamed along like zeppelins, the last real monsters of the sea, whose size was only known from the fragments found inside whales. What would happen if a wave caught the canoe broadside and capsized them? How long would they last? Bond took an ounce more pains with his steering and put the thought aside. 1 o'clock. 2 o'clock. 3. 4. Quarrel awoke and stretched. He called softly to Bond.
"I smells land, Cap'n."
Soon there was a thickening of the darkness ahead. The low shadow slowly took on the shape of a huge swimming rat. A pale moon rose slowly behind them. Now the island showed distinctly a couple of miles away, and there was the distant grumble of surf. They changed places. Quarrel brought down the sail, and they took up the paddles. For at least another mile, thought Bond, they would be invisible in the troughs of the waves. Not even radar would distinguish them from the crests. It was the last mile they would have to hurry over, with the dawn not far off. Now he too could smell the land. It had no particular scent. It was just something new in the nose after hours of clean sea. He could make out the white fringe of surf. The swell subsided, and the waves became choppier.
"Now, Cap'n," called Quarrel.
And Bond, the sweat already dropping off his chin, dug deeper and more often. God, it was hard work. The hulking log of wood which had sped along so well under the sail now seemed hardly to move. The wave at the bows was only a ripple. Bond's shoulders were aching like fire. The one knee he was resting on was beginning to bruise. His hands were cramped on the clumsy shaft of a paddle made of lead. It was incredible, but they were coming up with the reef. Patches of sand showed deep under the boat. Now the surf was a roar. They followed along the edge of the reef, looking for an opening. 100 yards inside the reef, breaking the sand line, was the shimmer of water running inland. The river. So the landfall had been all right. The wall of surf broke up. There was a patch of black oily current swelling over hidden coral heads. The nose of the canoe turned towards it and into it. There was a turmoil of water and a series of grating thuds. and then a sudden rush forward into peace, and the canoe was moving slowly across a smooth mirror towards the shore. Quarrel steered the boat towards the lee of a rocky promontory where the beach ended. Bond wondered why the beach didn't shine white under the thin moon. When they grounded, and Bond climbed stiffly out, he understood why. The beach was black. The sand was soft and wonderful to the feet, but it must have been formed out of volcanic rock, pounded over the centuries, and Bond's naked feet on it looked like white crabs. They made haste. Quarrel took three short lengths of thick bamboo out of the boat and laid them up the flat beach. They heaved the nose of the canoe onto the first and pushed the boat up the rollers. After each yard of progress, Bond picked up the back roller and brought it to the front. Slowly the canoe moved up the sand until at last it was over the back tide line and among the rocks and turtle grass and low sea-grape bushes. They pushed it another 20 yards inland into the beginning of the mangrove. There they covered it with dried seaweed and bits of driftwood from the tide line. Then Quarrel cut lengths of screw palm and went back over their tracks, sweeping and tidying. It was still dark, but the breath of grey in the east would soon be turning to pearl. It was 5 o'clock. They were dead tired. They exchanged a few words, and Quarrel went off among the rocks on the promontory. Bond scooped out a depression in the fine dry sand under a thick bush of sea-grape. There were a few hermit crabs beside his bed. He picked up as many as he could find and hurled them into the mangrove. Then, not caring what other animals or insects might come to his smell and his warmth, he lay down full length in the sand and rested his head on his arm. He was at once asleep. Chapter 8. The Elegant Venus. Bond awoke lazily. The feel of the sand reminded him where he was. He glanced at his watch. 10 o'clock. The sun through the round thick leaves of the sea-grape was already hot. A larger shadow moved across the dappled sand in front of his face. Quarrel? Bond shifted his head and peered through the fringe of leaves and grass that concealed him from the beach. He stiffened. His heart missed a beat and then began pounding so that he had to breathe deeply to quieten it. His eyes, as he stared through the blades of grass, were fierce slits. It was a naked girl, with her back to him. This book is continued on Disc 3.